Think for a minute about all that could be or has been written about that historical period in the early 1940s, from 1941 to 1945. So from the time that the United States entered World War II, December 7th, 1941, until the end of the war in 1945. So we're not even really talking about a total of 4 years. And yet, there have been volumes written on that war. In fact, I'm in what's called the History Book Club. And so every month I get recommended feature books or whatever, and I can choose or to get them or not. But I'm amazed at how many books are written, and some that are new off the shelf, off the press, related to World War II. I mean, you could fill a library probably with just books on World War II. And yet, you could also summarize that whole period of time in less than a paragraph. You can say, the United States entered the war in December 1941 when Pearl Harbor, or when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. We declared war and entered into the war. And we fought in that war until finally the Allied forces defeated Germany and the Axis forces, and they surrendered, and then we dropped the bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and Japan surrendered in 1945. There you go. Summarized 4 years of battle, of warfare, in a paragraph. Well, in Joshua 11, verses 16 to 23, this passage that we read this afternoon, these final two paragraphs are the paragraphs of the conquest of the Israelites in the land of Canaan. And as a result of that conquest, Israel essentially takes control of that territory that the Lord promised his people. And I want you to notice in the reading, maybe you did as we were reading it, the emphasis on the totality of that conquest. Nine times in those verses, you read the word all in the King James, and one time the word whole. Did you happen to notice that? I kind of highlighted them in my Bible. So in verse 16, Josh took all the land, all the south country, all the land of Goshen. Verse 17, all their kings. Verse 18, all those kings. Verse 19, all other they took in battle. Verse 21, from all the mountains of Judah, from all the mountains of Israel. Verse 23, according to all that the Lord said to Moses. And then the word whole at the beginning of verse 23, Joshua took the whole land. So the Lord is emphasizing through the way he inspired this to be recorded for us that this conquest was, there was a totality to this conquest. Now we're going to go on in Joshua and find out that there were still strongholds in the land, just kind of pockets of resistance, if you will, in the land that never actually got rooted out and caused problems. But as far as taking control of that territory, this passage summarizes the fact that Joshua led the Israelites to take control. So these eight verses then demonstrate to us that the Lord is indeed faithful to his word. As I said earlier, you know, God had promised hundreds of years ago that to Abraham, before, you know, when it was just Abraham, that his descendants would have this land. And now, here it is. The land is there. But God reveals more than his faithfulness in this passage. He reveals to us what he does in the giving of that victory. And I want us to see a few things in this passage, four specifically, that God does in the giving of victory in the fulfillment of his promise. Father, encourage us through these evidences of your work, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, verses 16 through 19, what I want us to see, first of all, is that the Lord, in giving this victory, providentially uses human leaders. He providentially uses human leaders. Now, the victory of Israel over Canaan is really overwhelming. Joshua took all the land. Again, it was these alls that I read earlier. He took all the land. He took all the geographical, the different geographic regions. He took all the kings. He took all the cities in battle, except for Gibeon. He didn't take Gibeon in battle, but the Gibeonites gave Israel the city, basically. So the victory here is overwhelming. But what I want you to notice is who is given the credit. To whom is this credit given? Verse 16 says, "So Joshua took all that land." The last part of verse 17. "All their kings he," Joshua, "took." In verse 18, "Joshua made war a long time with all those kings." The last part of verse 21, "Joshua destroyed them utterly with their cities." First part of verse 23. "So Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord had said unto Moses." So Joshua, the Israelites get the victory, overcome the Canaanites, but Joshua is given the credit. Now, why is that? Well, we can say one of the reasons is simply that Joshua is the leader that was chosen and appointed by the Lord to lead his people into this victory. Joshua was the one who was given the responsibility to wage those battles. So that the fact that Joshua faithfully carried out his appointed task to which he was chosen, and he carried out the responsibility that was placed upon his shoulders, God sees fit to record for eternity the credit for this victory going to that leader, to Joshua. Now, there are a couple of things I want to make, ways of application that I want to make for this. One is that there is no harm in recognizing the accomplishments of people who carry out their responsibilities well. There is sometimes in our conservative, wanting to give God glory, honor God way of thinking, that kind of says, we don't want to praise people too much because it'll fuel their pride, and we don't want to give them the big head. Well, Joshua is given the credit here, and God is the one who gives it to him, and by his divine inspiration. So I don't think we should be so skittish about recognizing the accomplishments of people who carry out their responsibilities well. Give them the pat on the back. Give them the award, whatever it is that is worthy of that work that they did. There's a corollary to that when you're on the receiving end. And the corollary is to beware of the false humility that says, "Oh, well, it wasn't me. The Lord did it all." Did that just kind of rattle you a little bit? And you said, "Well, that's what we ought to say. We ought to say, well, it wasn't me. The Lord did it all." Well, you know what? Frankly, that's not altogether true. There is some truth to it, but that's not altogether true. Here's what I mean by that. Would you expect, let's say I go to Micron tomorrow, and there's two people who work on two different lines. There's a bunch of people who work on different lines, but there's two people I'm singling out. One of those persons is a believer, and the other person is an unbeliever. And both of these people are excelling at the work that they're doing. They both have skill and dexterity with their hands, and so they can do what they're doing quickly and efficiently, and they can do so accurately. Not everybody has that skill. So they're doing their job, and they're doing very, very well. Okay, so the human resources lady tells me, these two people, they're just outstanding in what they're doing. They're head and shoulders above everybody else. And so I go to the one person who's a believer, and I say, "Hey, you're really to be commended for your diligence and your skill and for your faithfulness in doing this job and doing it so well." And he says, oh, well, you know, it's not me. It's the Lord that's doing it all. But then I go to the other person and I say to him, you know, you're really doing a great job here, and you're to be commended for being diligent and using your skill and ability to do the work so well and turning out such good work. And he says, oh, thank you. Now, why should this guy say, well, no, it wasn't me, it's the Lord? This guy say, well, thank you. He said, well, because he's an unbeliever. He doesn't give God credit for anything. No, the deal is, this guy has an accurate understanding that the product here, the work that's been done, is because he's used his skills and abilities and his responsibilities that God's, he wouldn't put it this way, but that God's put on his shoulders to carry out his work. And it's work that's well done, and it deserves to be commended. And he is rightly commended. This guy over here is acting like God hasn't given him any skill. God hasn't given him any responsibility. God hasn't given him dexterity in his hands. They are things that God has given him, and he has put them to work. He has the worker has employed those things. And to commend him for that is a right thing to do, and for him to say, thank you, is an appropriate response. Don't be afraid to say thank you when you've done your job and you've done it well. And I don't think that's an illegitimate application of this very thing. God is commending Joshua here and saying that Joshua did this. Now, the thing of it is, when we look back, when we step back and we get the whole picture, we know that God is the ultimate authority. Let's look at verse 20. Verse 20 says, It was of the Lord to harden the hearts of the Canaanites, that they should come against Israel in battle, that he, the Lord, might destroy them utterly, and that they might have no favor, but that he, the Lord, might destroy them. And yet, at the end of verse 21, Joshua destroyed them utterly with their cities. Well, who destroyed them then? Was it Joshua or was it the Lord? Well, yes. Yes. It was Joshua as an instrument in the hands of the Lord. So you say, well, therefore, it is appropriate to say, well, it wasn't me, it was the Lord. No. It's appropriate to say, I thank the Lord that in his grace he chooses to use an instrument such as I to accomplish his work. And I thank the Lord that he has given me the skill and the ability. And I thank the Lord for what he has used me to accomplish. But yes, thank you. I did do that work. And thank God for giving me the ability to do it. So the Lord is the ultimate authority. Joshua led the army. Joshua led the army to fight the battles. The Israelites fought the battles. But the Lord destroyed. So the Lord providentially uses human leaders. So Joshua's, in quotation marks, whoever they might happen to be, are divinely chosen human instruments whose skills and talents and abilities God uses to accomplish his purposes. The Lord providentially uses human leaders. Second thing I want us to notice here in verse 20 is that the Lord sovereignly ordains judgment. Here's where that first song we sang comes into play. God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. God sovereignly ordains judgment. I don't know if this verse troubled you when we read it, but it says, it was of the Lord to harden the hearts of the Canaanites, that they should come against Israel in battle, that he might destroy them utterly, that they might have no favor, they might have no mercy, but that he might destroy them. The Lord sovereignly ordains judgment. Now, if you think about this, this is really the other side of the Lord providentially using a leader to give victory. You follow what I mean there? I know, it's 1:30 in the afternoon, you've had lunch, it's nap time. But follow this. If the Lord providentially uses a leader, he picks that leader, he uses that leader to go into battle and to give victory over a foe, then the other side of that providential using of the leader is that the Lord has sovereignly ordained the judgment on that foe against whom the divinely chosen leader is fighting. You follow? Well, how he did this, the Lord did this in verse 20, is that he hardened hearts. It was of the Lord to harden their hearts. And the hearts that he hardened were all of these, the peoples that populated the hills, the north, the south country, the land of Goshen, the valley, et cetera, through verses 16, 17, and the kings of verse 18. And yet we come to verse 19 and says, there was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel, save the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon. All other they took in battle. All right, now watch this. What this means, verse 20 means, is that the Lord sovereignly hardened the hearts of all of the Canaanites, except he did not harden the hearts of the Gibeonites. The Lord did not harden the hearts of the Gibeonites, but instead gave them humble hearts. It was the Gibeonites, because of God's grace to them, it was the Gibeonites that came to Israel and served as a test to Israel. But it was also the grace of God to the Gibeonites to give them a humble heart that they would come to Israel and offer themselves to serve Israel and to serve God and to serve God's people. This was of the Lord. This isn't the first time we read in the Bible of God hardening someone's heart. You go back to the book of Exodus, and you read about the Lord hardening, repeatedly hardening the heart of Pharaoh, that Pharaoh would not let Israel go. So the Lord hardened the hearts of these Canaanites, and he did so purposefully. He did so purposefully. Look at the explanation. Why did the Lord harden their hearts? The Lord hardened their hearts so that they should come against Israel in battle. The Lord hardened the hearts of the Canaanites so that the Canaanites would initiate hostilities. Now, the wonderful thing about that is that the initiation of the hostilities for the vast majority of the Canaanites was not on the Israelites. They did Jericho and Ai, but then they remained in their camp. They went to their camp. The Gibeonites came to them, and they made peace with the Gibeonites, and the Gibeonites went back to their cities, and then the Israelites found out, oh, you guys are really close. And they went to confront the Gibeonites, and then next thing you know, you've got this coalition of forces that are going to attack and destroy the Gibeonites because they made peace with Israel, and then Israel is brought into that battle because of their allegiance with the Gibeonites. So Israel didn't initiate that battle. And then the next thing you know, you got this northern coalition of forces that get together and say, hey, we got to go attack these Israelites. We can't let them have this land. So the northern coalition attacks Israel. The Lord hardened their hearts so that they would initiate the hostilities. And then notice the second purpose in verse 20. Not only that they would initiate the hostilities, but he did so that they, the Canaanites, might be judged finally. That he might destroy them utterly. My friend Rhett Dodson put it this way. He says, it was God's purpose to annihilate the Canaanites and to show them no mercy. Does that rattle you? It was his purpose to do so. But it was. So the Lord acted sovereignly to harden their hearts. He acted purposefully. And then let me focus on that idea of his sovereignty in doing so. The Lord acted sovereignly. Because watch, look. The Lord chose Israel, not Canaan. The Lord had mercy on Israel and not on Canaan. Again, as Dodson says, he says, all of this falls under the purview of God's sovereignty, that Israel possessed the land and the Canaanites were killed and driven from their cities can be explained only in terms of sovereign grace and sovereign judgment. And the judgment here is that Canaan's iniquity finally became full. Let me show you what I mean. Turn back to, again, back to Genesis. Go back to Genesis chapter 15 and look at verse 16. This is where God is establishing this covenant with Abraham. And he says to Abraham in verse 15 of Genesis 15, "Thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace." In other words, you're going to die. You're going to die in peace. And you're going to be buried in a good old age. "But in the fourth generation, they shall come hither again." Your descendants will come back here again. For why? For why not now? Why don't you just give us this land now? Here's the explanation. "For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full." So there are these hundreds of years, literally, that go by from the time God gives this covenant promise to Abraham until the Israelites actually take the land of Canaan and take control of that territory. This all this time goes by, which is really mercy. But in that mercy, the Canaanites do what man so typically does when God is merciful. Just lets sin go all the more rampant. So finally, here it is, when Joshua comes into the land of Canaan and God gives him these victories over the Canaanites, he hardens the hearts of the Canaanites because out of judgment, their iniquity became full. All right, so this, as Dotson says, this is sovereign judgment, but this is also sovereign grace. And it's sovereign grace because, well, let's turn to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 9. It's sovereign grace because the fact of the matter is the Israelites really didn't deserve any better. Really? Well, let's see what God says. In Deuteronomy chapter 9, listen to what he says through Moses to the Israelites. He says, chapter 9, verse 4, Deuteronomy, "Speak not thou in thine heart after the Lord thy God hath cast them out from before thee, saying..." So Moses says, when you've come into the land and you've taken over the land of Canaan, then don't say in your heart that for my righteousness the Lord hath brought me in to possess this land. In other words, okay, here, now they're victorious. God has given them this land, and the Canaanites have all been destroyed, and now the land is ours. And God is saying, okay, at that point, don't you dare stop and say, it's because we're so righteous. Look at the rest of it. Let's go on here. He says, "That's not why God brought you in to possess this land, but for the wickedness of these nations the Lord doth drive them out from before thee. Not for thy righteousness or for the uprightness of thine heart dost thou go to possess their land." Really? No. Why? Because for the wickedness of these nations the Lord thy God doth drive them out from before thee, and that he may perform the word which the Lord sware unto thy fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Understand, therefore..." Let me see how far I want to go here. "Understand, therefore, that the Lord thy God giveth thee not this good land to possess it for thy righteousness." Here's why. Here it is. "For you are a stiff-necked people." You're a stiff-necked people. In other words, you're not getting this because you deserve it. You're getting this because of grace. In fact, the Lord so much as says that a few chapters earlier in chapter 7, Deuteronomy 7, look at verse 6 and 8. 6 through 8. He says, "For thou art an holy people unto the Lord thy God." That is, you are a set apart people unto the Lord thy God. "The Lord thy God hath chosen thee to be a special people unto himself, above all people that are upon the face of the earth. The Lord did not set his love upon you nor choose you because you were more in number than any people, for you were the fewest of all people. Well, why did the Lord choose us? Why did the Lord set his love upon us? But because the Lord loved you. That's why. The Lord loved you because he loved you. And remember that concept of that Hebrew concept of love isn't that emotional, gushy, touchy-feely thing. It's the concept of Jacob have I chosen, Esau have I rejected. Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. Jacob have I chosen, Esau have I rejected. So the Lord is saying to the Israelites in Deuteronomy 7, you are getting this land not because you're so special, but because I've made you special. You're not getting this land because you're so holy or you're so righteous. You're getting this land because I have made you holy. I've set you apart. You're not getting this land because you're more numerous than anybody else, because you're not. You're smaller than anybody else. I have set my love upon you because I have set my love upon you. That's sovereign grace. So the Lord here is in giving this victory, in giving this, conquering this land in Joshua chapter 11, the Lord sovereignly ordains this judgment. Now, going back to this idea of him hardening the hearts of the Canaanites and giving the land to the Israelites, there's no question but what that causes us a little discomfort. Let me share with you Dodson's comments on that discomfort. He says, why does God harden people? Is he harsh and vindictive? Is he a cosmic bully? Not at all. Do not imagine that God came to people who lived in blissful spiritual neutrality and cruelly said, I think I will harden your hearts. The Canaanites were like everyone born into this world after the fall. They were born with depraved, rebellious hearts that were already hard toward God. God made harder what was already obdurate as an act of judgment in order that these people might ultimately be destroyed. Does God harden everyone this way? No. Remember the Gibeonites? Even though everyone is born depraved and spiritually dead toward God, not everyone is left to become harder and eventually perish. What God did with Israel, with Pharaoh, and with the Canaanites, he continues to do. He has mercy on whom he chooses to have mercy, and others he hardens that they may continue in their rebellion and be judged. Does it seem unfair to you that God should decide to save some and pass by others? And he uses this illustration. He says, I have a good friend named Chris who is a potter. Chris casts molds for commercial pots, and he also makes bowls and vases that are beautiful works of art. I've been in Chris's studio a number of times, but never once have I heard a pot argue with him. Never have I heard one say, I don't want to be a planter. I want to be a beautiful vase. Nor have I gone into his studio and said, Chris, do not waste your time with those exquisite colors and intricate shapes for a vase. Just make a plain brown pot. Why are there no arguments with the pottery? Why do I not decide what Chris makes and the way he makes it? Because when he goes into his studio to work, the things that happen, the forms that take shape, the colors that are mixed are all done according to his plan. Chris, not the clay, nor his friends, runs the studio. Is this not the way the Apostle Paul responds to those who object to God's sovereign election and call him unjust? Quote, but who are you, O man, to answer back to God? Will what is molded say to its molder, why have you made me like this? As the potter, no right over the clay to make out of the same lump one vessel for honorable use and another for dishonorable use? Romans chapter 9, verses 20 and 21. We come to this place of really accepting peace and come to terms with and come become peace at peace with the sovereignty of God in this matter. It gives great rest to our souls, especially if we are children of his promise. So the Lord providentially uses human leaders. The Lord sovereignly ordains judgment. And then in verses 21 and 22, the Lord powerfully overcomes fear. He powerfully overcomes fear. Verses 21 and 22 talk about Joshua cutting off the Anakims from the mountains and from all the mountains of Judah, all the mountains of Israel, destroying them utterly, leaving no Anakims in the land of Canaan. The only Anakim left were in Gaza, and Ashdod. There remain some. Now, these Anakim previously had provoked disobedience and death. Let's look back and see. Turn back to the book of Numbers. Numbers chapter 13. Numbers 13. And look at verses 27 and 28. The spies whom Moses had sent into the land of Canaan, the promised land. Remember those spies? They came back, and verse 27 says, they told him, the spies told Moses and said, we came into the land whither thou sentest us, and surely it floweth with milk and honey, and this is the fruit of it. Nevertheless, they say, the people be strong that dwell in the land, and the cities are walled and very great. And moreover, we saw the children of Anak there. We saw the Anakim there. Now look at verse 33. It says, and there we saw the giants, the sons of Anak, which come of the giants, and we were in our own sight as grasshoppers, and so we were in their sight. All right, well, there's the report. There are Anakim in this land, these giants, these big. And what did that do? It provoked fear on the part of the Israelites, which then in verses 1 to 4 of chapter 14 displaced their faith. God had told them, you can take this land. Oh, but there are Anakim there. They're too big for us. We're afraid of them. In verses 1 to 4, they say at the end of verse 4, let's make a captain and let's return to Egypt. And that, of course, provoked their disobedience. They did not go into the land. And then you know the rest of the story, right? What happened to that whole generation that refused to believe God? They all perished. That was 40 years ago. 40 plus years ago. Here they are a generation later, led by Joshua, and in faithful obedience, they are given the victory. God overcomes, uses their faith to overcome their fear. They cut off all of the Anakim, and they do so completely. The Lord powerfully overcomes fear. And then finally, in verse 23, the Lord graciously grants rest. Verse 23 says, Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord had said unto Moses. Joshua gave it for an inheritance unto Israel according to their divisions by their tribes, and the land rested from war. So, Joshua took the whole land. The Lord kept his whole word. The people received their promised inheritance, and the Lord granted a divine rest. The Lord granted a divine rest. Now for Israel, God gave his people, through Joshua, rest, which means, what did he give them? He gave them a place. There's no more wandering. And he gave them peace. No more war, fighting, conflict to gain the land. He gave them a place and he gave them peace. What did Jesus say in Matthew 11:28? Come unto me, say it with me, come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. I will give you rest. And in the Lord giving us rest, God, what is the New Testament name for Joshua? Jesus. For us, God gives us rest in Jesus, our Joshua, and gives that rest in Jesus alone. Come unto me, Jesus says, and I will give you rest. And what is that rest? What is it that he gives? John 14. Verse 1, let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid. Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many dwelling places, many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you, I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there you may be also. God gives us rest in Jesus alone and promises us a place. And he also promises us peace. Verse 27, Jesus says, peace I leave with you. My peace I give unto you. Not as the world gives, give I unto you. Then he says, let not your heart be troubled. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid. I give you place, I give you peace. The Lord graciously grants rest. And right about now you're saying, good, because I'm going to go home and take a nap. But more importantly, have you found that rest that our Joshua, Jesus, alone can give? Father in heaven, I trust each one in this room has. If not, may today be the day you bring rest to their soul. Pray in Jesus' name. Amen.